Well, we greet you again in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. We come to you again by tape. It looks at this stage that we'll do so for the rest of the month. We're making this on Thursday night at home, and you're listening to it on a Sunday night. Now, at the time we make this tape, we're feeling pretty good, and we want you to know that. We've been taking some extra vitamins, and the Lord seems to be working where the doctors aren't, so we're feeling a little better than we have energy-wise, at least in the last few weeks, and we thank you for your prayers and ask you to continue to pray for us. Now, we're in Genesis chapter 49. If you'll turn with us, why, we'll get right started right away. Genesis chapter 49. And Jacob called unto his sons and said, "Gather yourselves together, that I may tell you that which shall befall you in the last days. Gather yourselves together, and hear ye sons of Jacob, and hearken unto Israel your father." Now it's Jacob talking at the start, but he's switching to Israel, and in the blessings or the cursings, as the case may be, he places upon his sons, he's not speaking as a father. He's speaking as prophet of God. He's speaking as Israel. And he starts with his firstborn, Reuben. And he says, "Reuben, thou art my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity and the excellency of power." That's the way he started out and what he should have been. "Unstable as water, thou shalt not excel, because thou wentest up to thy father's bed, then defilest thou it." He went up to my couch. In other words, he says, you're going to lose the blessings. He doesn't bless them as would be normal and would be expected of the firstborn son as a custom. In other words, he didn't inherit the priestly line. He didn't inherit the bulk of the material wealth. He didn't inherit the authority over his brothers. He didn't receive the position that would have gone as the head of the line. Verse 5. "Simeon and Levi are brethren, instruments of cruelty are in their habitations. O my soul, come not thou unto their secret, unto their assembly mine honor. Be not thou united, for in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they digged down a wall. Cursed be their anger, for it was fierce, and their wrath, for it was cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel." You remember these two boys? You remember when their sister, was it Dinah, that had the unfortunate experience? And when the families involved attempted to patch it up, and the young man wanted to marry her, how these two boys deceived them and went in and destroyed the bulk of the people. It was an unholy thing they did. Now, it could be excused. I could say the crime that was committed deserved punishment, and maybe it did. But should the whole race of people, the whole group, the whole family be utterly and completely destroyed? Was it a pronouncement of God, or was it their own willful judgment? You know, one thing that we should note as we go ahead in these studies over the months ahead, God sets down some patterns for justice, and man isn't supposed to step outside of them or to set them aside. And these boys just took things completely into their own hands, and what they did was totally without precedent. They were wrong. They willfully murdered is what they did. And their father, at the prompting of the Spirit, is saying they are totally unworthy of any position. And from what I see in my commentaries, these two sons and their families were scattered among their brothers. They didn't receive an inheritance. The Levites became the priests, and that seems strange. Yet if you analyze that a little bit, it's interesting in the fact that probably the most sinful originator of a family here becomes the one who takes the position of, in effect, interceding. He is conscious of sin. His descendants will be conscious of sin in the lives of people for a long while. Somebody says it takes one to know one, and that's used in many respects. And the world knows a sinner when it meets one. And a child of God should know a child of God when he meets one. In this case, Levi, descendants of Levi, are to be the priest. That'll come later. Judah, verse 8. Thou art he whom thy brethren shall praise. Thy hand shall be in the neck of thine enemies. Thy father's children shall bow down before thee. Judah is a lion's whelp from the prey. My son, thou art gone up. He stooped down, he couched as a lion, and as an old lion, who shall rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be, binding his foal unto the vine, and his ass's colt unto the choice vine. He washed his garments in wine, and his clothes in the blood of grapes. His eyes shall be red with wine, and his teeth white with milk. Now, there's a lot there, but what it's really saying, all the best of the blessings will go to this son. This is where the Jews came from. The other tribes, they fade out of history. They talk about the lost tribes of Israel. The Jews, the tribe of Judah, remains. These are the Jews. Not all of Israel, but these are the Jews. And these promises go to them. The brothers will bow down and they will rule, or he will rule. His children and his descendants will rule. And this is the line through which we get our son. There's some question, verse 12, his eyes shall be red with wine. You would get the impression that bloodshot, a drunkard, that's not the interpretation given by most of the commentaries. They say that what that actually means is it'll shine with the brightness of light reflected off a bottle of wine or the wine, the surface of wine. And it means bright eyes and the white, his teeth white with milk. It won't mean that milk will color their teeth, but the teeth will, in other words, he'll be a healthy, bright individual. Then we get to Zebulun. He will dwell at the haven of the sea, and he shall be for a haven of ships, and his border shall be unto Zidon. And we're told that from the best evidence, they cooperated and worked with the Phoenicians, who became, as you probably know in your history. I'm going to leave that telephone ring right in there. You know what I put up with when I make these tapes sometimes. A small interruption. All right, we're talking about Zebulun and the Phoenicians. They cooperated with Phoenicians, and they were a seaport visited by them, and they were in effect a channel of commerce through to the other tribes through their this particular blessing, their usage by the God. In the plan of God in this fashion. Issachar is a strong ass couching down between two burdens, and he saw that rest was good, and the land that it was pleasant, and bowed his shoulder to bear, and became a servant under tribute. Commentaries seem to agree that, in effect, this was a prediction that, and it was fulfilled, it seemed to be that way, that this particular tribe would determine to that peace and prosperity was more important than freedom, and that they would submit to slavery, literally, in order to have peace and lack of conflict. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent by the way, an adder in the path that biteth the horse's heel, so that his rider shall fall backward. I have waited for thy salvation, O Lord. The thing is really that Dan will be the, in effect, the descendants of Dan would be a military defender of these people, the one that would be willing to move out and occupy the land and be of the aggressive nature. Now, we're told that they didn't have any special spiritual attributes that showed up in their history. Verse 19, Gad, a troop shall overcome him, but he shall overcome at the last. And that's pretty much self-explanatory. They would be defeated, but they would be victorious in the end. You know, you look around, you see some of today's present history in a way, don't we? We look back and we see how the natures of these people reflect maybe even in our own history. We wonder if we might not be something like Issachar, when we should be more like maybe Dan. Naphtali is a hind let loose. He giveth goodly words. And represents this individual's, I skipped one, didn't I? His love of freedom. And the one before that, Asher, it says of him, bread shall be fat, and he shall yield royal dainties, prosperity, happy. Well-being, physical blessings. And then it gets down to Joseph. As a fruitful bough, even a fruitful bough by a well, whose branches run over the wall. The archers have sorely grieved him and shot at him and hated him. But his bow abode in strength, and in the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. From thence is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. Even by the God of thy father who shall help thee, and by the Almighty who shall bless thee with the blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lieth under, blessings of the breast and of the womb. The blessings of thy father have prevailed above the blessings of thy progenitors under the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. They shall be on the head of Joseph, on the crown of the head of him that was separate from his brethren. As you well know, we've been over the last few weeks the story of Joseph and how his brothers reacted and treated him. Jealousy, hostility. We've been all through that. His two sons, though, would have two places of inheritance in the tribes of Israel. They would make up two tribes. They'd literally take the place of Simon and Levi. And there would still be 12 tribes. And then through them would come much of the blessings of the nation known as Israel, the family of Israel. Now, history tells us that most of these other tribes, these other 10 tribes, have faded away, and these blessings have come down through the ones that we call the Jews now. And we find that the Levites and the Benjamites, we missed Benjamin, didn't we? We'll get him in a minute. The tribe of Judah and the tribe of Joseph pretty well combined into one eventually. Now, I may be in error in that. I'm going to have to go back and do a little more research on it, but we'll come to it later, I'm sure. We come to verse 27, and Benjamin shall raven as a wolf. In the morning he shall devour the prey, and at night he shall divide the spoil. I wonder how it hurt the this father who, at one time, was left only with Benjamin, and who, in the absence of Joseph, Benjamin became the apple of his father's eye, by the Spirit of God, would be required to state these facts about his son. He'd be a ravening wolf and seek a prey, and in a certain sense, he would become almost like Simon and or Simeon and Levi. He would seek a prey continually. It wouldn't be a nice thing, would it? All right. Now we come to another kind of a closing of a period in the history of the nation of Israel. Verse 28. All these are the 12 tribes of Israel, and this is it that their father spake unto them and blessed them. Everyone according to his blessing he blessed them, and he charged them and said unto them, I am to be gathered unto my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephraim, the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre, in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field of Ephron, the Hittite, for possession of a burying place. There they buried Abraham and Sarah his wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah his wife, and there I buried Leah. The purchase of the field and of that cave that is therein was from the children of Heb. And when Jacob had made an end of commanding his sons, he gathered up his feet under the bed and yielded up the ghost and was gathered unto his people. Now, I can just kind of visualize this. I can see an old gentleman sitting on the side of his bed with each of these sons coming up, and he places his hand upon the head and then prophesies concerning the future of the descendants of that individual, and for good or bad. And he's doing this as Israel, not as Jacob. I think he's doing it with maybe a broken heart of a father who's seen many of his sons go wrong, and yet pleased in the spirit of Israel with the prophecies concerning the coming Messiah through Judah, and the blessings that some of his other sons, including Joseph, would still be to his descendants. He's sitting there and he pronounces the last comment upon Benjamin, and then he tells him, my father before me, and his father, and their wives, and my wife, are buried at this place. And I extract from you a promise that you will bury me there. And then he lifts up his feet onto the bed, lays back, and dies. You know, I've been reading much this week, and I've been given a book to read in relation to some ancient, almost it seems, history of the Methodist movement from the viewpoint of one particular minister. And in it, repeatedly, is given the testimony of the death of one who is right with the Lord, and many times the testimony concerning the individual who does not have peace with God. And the contrast is extreme. The child of God knows what he's going to face, and he can go without fear of what's awaiting him. The one who doesn't know Christ, who does not have peace with God through the blood of Christ, must face an angry God, a God of judgment, a God of justice, because he's refused the grace of a loving Father. I find it hard to understand why men will continue to refuse the grace of God. We preach, and sometimes I know that I can strongly be suspect in many eyes in the way I do preach, because I get so much joy out of preaching the love of God for the lost sinner. God has done all that he can with an infinite love for his children. And maybe I overdo the preaching of God's love sometimes, and I could be criticized for it. It is necessary at times to point out the judgments of God. And a little hellfire and brimstone sometimes needs to be preached. I think that a preacher fails when he does not present the other side, when he does not tell the people what they're going to face if they refuse the free gift of God. You know, I don't think there's a one of us that would dare go up to the President of the United States and spit in his face. It's just inconceivable. Oh, sure, somebody can get up on a second or third story warehouse and use a rifle with a scope on it and shoot a president. That doesn't take much courage. Doesn't take much brains either. But I think that most of us respect the office, at least, and we just simply wouldn't do that. Yet, many of these same individuals who wouldn't do what I just suggested do the same thing to God and to Christ. In the story of the crucifixion, and we're coming up to that in the next few days, the fact that they spit upon him and they pulled his beard out and they put the crown of thorns on his head, we shake our head and we criticize that and we purse our lips and furrow our brows and say, oh, that's terrible. But how many people today are doing the same thing? The story of the gospel is presented, the right of God to judge his children, the right of God to pronounce the way of salvation and set the way and prescribe it. And we know the terrible sinfulness of sin, and yet we persist and we refuse God's grace. I can't understand it. To me, in the years, maybe it's wrong, but in the years since I've received Christ, maybe the memory's faded a little bit, and I can't understand why an individual can go around and refuse the grace of God. You know, I went 28 years before anyone bothered to tell me the story. And it seems to me that as soon as my mind could grasp the meaning of it all, in the least sense, that I had to receive Christ. And so to me, it seems inconceivable that somebody could hear the story and continue to reject Christ. I don't understand it. To me, it's a terrible thing. And I guess maybe in coming months you'll hear a little more of the other side. It needs to be preached. I don't like to do it, but I think I'm going to have to, and you're going to have to pray that I do it and do it in a loving way. This is the thing that is important today. All right, now let's go along. We have one more chapter. Maybe we can finish it in just a few minutes. Rather than read it all, we will simply comment about it. In the first couple of verses, we find the sorrow of Joseph, and then his response to the instructions of his father, and his use of his authority to have his father mummified and embalmed, and the days, verse 3, that it took to complete the embalming process. It was a long process, 40 days, and 30 more days of mourning, make a total of 70 days, and then the leaving of this very strange procession from the land of Egypt into the land of Canaan. Joseph taking leave of Pharaoh and taking a escort of Egyptian soldiers, an honor guard, and his family and his brothers and their families, all making this trek back to the land of Canaan to deposit the body in the grave that was reserved for Israel. And the testimony left behind in this land by the sorrow and the importance of what appeared to be the mighty king of Egypt, really in a sense. At least his sons obeyed the last command of Israel. They took him home and they buried him in the land of promise. And then we're told that Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brethren, and the fear of his brothers, the horror, the power of a guilty conscience. They feared Joseph, in spite of the some years, I don't know exactly how many, but a number of years, that they, probably seven, or the majority of 7 years, or maybe more, that they lived under the care of Joseph in the land of Egypt. And his demonstrations of his concern for them, they felt that he was doing it only for the sake of his father. And now that his father was gone, their father, he would get even. They just couldn't understand the working of God in the life of their brother. Now, you know, this brings up a question. In the sense that we think of salvation on the basis of faith in God and His Word and His promises, as exemplified and performed through Christ, would we consider all of these brothers saved? I don't think so. I really don't. You know, in our study of this family, we get the impression, you know, we seem to say, well, the 12 tribes of Israel, all, you know, the 12 sons, just because they're the sons of Israel, they have to be saved. I don't believe so. I think at least 8 or 10 are lost. There is very little evidence of the majority of these sons having any sense of spiritual values. We could look at Judah. We could look at Joseph and his sons. And let's see. I really don't know about the others. Well, let's stop right there. It's not our place to judge. But if we look at this on the evidence that we have, it would seem that maybe Judah and Joseph and their families were the only ones that put any value on the spiritual things. They got the blessings. They're the ones that seem to be received in the prophecies and accepted in the prophecies that Israel enumerated. And now they come home and are back to Egypt. They had to go back to Egypt. It would seem that maybe the 7 years of famine aren't over yet. And they had to go back to Egypt, and they're under the control of their brother. And they try to work a little politics with Joseph. Let's go to verse 16. And they sent a messenger unto Joseph, saying, "Thy father did command before he died, saying, So shall ye say unto Joseph, Forgive, I pray thee now, the trespasses of thy brethren and their sin. For they did unto thee evil, and now we pray thee, forgive the trespasses of thy servants, of the God of thy father." And Joseph wept when they spake unto him. And his brethren also went and fell down before his face, and they said, "Behold, we be thy servants." Now, think about that a little bit. They willingly fulfilled the prophecy that Joseph gave that time. They got him out there in the field and said, "I saw a dream," and it was interpreted as being that the brothers would bow down to him. First they send a messenger to plead their cause because they were afraid to face him. And then after the cause was pled, they came and they willingly bowed down and submitted themselves as servants of Joseph. And then what is Joseph's response? Well, Joseph said unto them, "Fear not, for am I in the place of God? But as for you, you thought evil against me." He knows what they thought. But God, see, God overruled. He controls. The end result is in the hands of God. And you need to remember that when you run into some hard times. God meant it unto good to bring to pass, as it is this day, to save much people alive. Now therefore fear ye not. I will nourish you and your little ones. And he comforted them and spake kindly unto them. And then it goes on. And it says that Joseph lived a total of 110 years. He saw his children grow up to the third generation. And then he died. And he gives a prophecy there in verse 24. And Joseph said unto his brethren, "I die, and God will surely visit you. and bring you out of this land, unto the land which he sware unto Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And Joseph took an oath of the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and ye shall carry up my bones from hence. So Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. Now, you know, that I don't think we run into it in Exodus. We'll get into Exodus next week. But can you visualize that coffin being cared for 400 and some years, and then being carried for 40 years through the wilderness? We may have some comment about that if we run into it later, but just 40 years in the wilderness when generations that never knew Joseph are required to tote that coffin around through the desert places, I wonder if they got a little irritated with it. They kept their promise, though. We hope that the Lord, we pray that the Lord will bless this study to your hearts tonight. We're looking forward, really, till a time we can be with you again in the evenings. We hope that the Lord restores our strength so that those nighttime trips will be a little easier on us. You be much in prayer, and I'm going to ask one of the gentlemen now if he'll come and close this service in prayer for us. May God bless you all abundantly.